This is Audible.
Brought to you by Penguin. The Night She Disappeared by Lisa Jewell. Read by Joanne Froggatt. Arachnophobia. Arachnophobia is one of those words that sounds as bad as that which it describes. The hard ack at the end of the second syllable, suggestive of the repulsive angles of a spider's legs. The soft sweep of the foe, like the awful wave of nausea that washes through your gut at the suggestion of a sudden movement across a wall or floor. The loud no at its centre, the sound of your brain screaming in disgust. No, 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 no. Tallulah suffers from arachnophobia. Tallulah is in the dark. Part 1. Chapter 1. June 2017. The baby is starting to grumble. Kim sits still in her chair and holds her breath. It's taken her all night to get him to sleep. It's Friday, a sultry midsummer's night, and normally she'd be out with friends at this time. 11 o'clock. She'd be at the bar getting in the last round for the road. But tonight she's in joggers and a t-shirt, her dark hair tied up in a bun, contacts out, glasses on, and a glass of lukewarm wine on the coffee table that she poured herself earlier and hasn't had a chance to drink. She clicks the volume down on the TV using the remote and listens again. There it is, the very early outposts of crying. A kind of dry, ominous chirruping. Kim has never really liked babies. She liked her own well enough, but did find the early years testing and ill-suited to her sensibilities. From the first night that both her children slept through the night, Kim has placed a very, possibly disproportionately, high value on an unbroken night. She had her kids young and easily had time enough and room in her heart for another one or two. But she could not face the prospect of sleepless nights again. For years she has protected her sleep vigilantly, with the help of eye masks and earplugs and pillow sprays and huge tubs of melatonin that her friend brings back for her from the States. And then, just over 12 months ago, her teenage daughter, Tallulah, had a baby. And now Kim is a grandmother at the age of 39, and there is a crying baby in her house again. Soon, it feels, so soon, after her own babies stopped crying. For the most part, despite it happening 10 years before she was ready for it, having a grandson has been blessing after blessing. His name is Noah, and he has dark hair like Kim, like both of Kim's children. Kim only ever really liked babies with dark hair. Blonde-haired babies freak her out. Noah has eyes that oscillate between brown and amber, depending on the light, and he has solid legs and solid arms, with circlets of fat at the wrists. He's quick to smile and laugh, and he's happy to entertain himself, sometimes for as long as half an hour at a time. Kim looks after him when Tallulah goes to college, and she occasionally gets a kick of panic in her gut at the realization that she has not heard him make a noise for a few minutes. She rushes to his high chair, or to the swing seat, or to the corner of the sofa to check that he is still alive, and finds him deep in thought whilst turning the pages of a fabric book. Noah is a dreamy baby, but he does not like to sleep, and Kim finds this darkly stressful. At the moment, Tallulah and Noah live here with Kim, alongside Zach, Noah's father. Noah sleeps between them in Tallulah's double bed, and Kim puts in her earplugs and plays some white noise on her smartphone, and is generally saved from the nighttime cacophony of Noah's sleeplessness. But tonight, Zach has taken Tallulah out on what they're calling a date night, which sounds strangely middle-aged for a pair of 19-year-olds. They've gone to the very pub that Kim would normally be sitting in tonight. She slipped Zach a £20 note as they were leaving and told them to have fun. It's the first time they've been out as a couple since before Noah was born. They split up while Tallulah was pregnant and got back together again about 6 months ago, with Zach pledging to be the best dad in the world, And, so far, he's been true to his word. Noah's crying has kicked in properly now, and Kim sighs and gets to her feet. As she does so, her phone buzzes with a text message. She clicks it and reads, "Mum, there's some people here from college. They asked us back to theirs, just for an hour or so. Is that okay?" Smiley face emoji. Then, as she's typing a reply, another message follows immediately. "Is Noah okay?" "Noah is fine," she types. "Good as gold. Go and have fun. Stay as long as you like. Love you." Kim goes upstairs to Noah's cot, her heart heavy with the prospect of another hour of rocking and soothing and sighing and whispering in the dark while the moon hangs out there in the balmy midsummer sky, which still holds pale smudges of daylight, and the house creaks emptily and other people sit in pubs. But, as she approaches him, the moonlight catches the curve of his cheek and she sees his eyes light up at the sight of her, hears his breath catch with relief that someone has come and sees his arms reach up to her. She collects him up and places him against her chest and says, "What's all the fuss about now, baby boy? What's all the fuss?" And her heart suddenly expands and contracts with the knowledge that this boy is a part of her and that he loves her, that he is not seeking out his mother. He is content for her to come to him in the dark of the night to comfort him. She takes Noah into the living room and sits him on her lap. She gives him the remote control to play with. He loves to press the buttons, but Kim can tell he's too tired to press buttons. He wants to sleep. As he grows heavy on top of her, she knows she should put him back into his cot. Good sleep hygiene, good habits, all of that. But now Kim is tired too, and her eyes grow heavy, and she pulls the throw from the sofa across her lap and adjusts the cushion behind her head, and she and Noah fall silently into a peaceful slumber. Kim awakes suddenly several hours later. The brief midsummer night is almost over, and the sky through the living room window is shimmering with the first blades of hot morning sun. She straightens her neck and feels all the muscles shout at her. Noah is still heavy with sleep, and she gently adjusts him so that she can reach her phone. It's 4:20 in the morning. She feels a blast of annoyance. She knows she told Tallulah to stay out as late as she liked, but this is madness. She brings up Tallulah's number and calls it. It goes straight to voicemail, so she brings up Zach's number and calls it. Again, it goes to voicemail. Maybe, she thinks, maybe they came in the night and saw Noah asleep on top of her and decided that it would be nice to have the bed to themselves. She pictures them peering at her around the door of the living room and taking off their shoes, tiptoeing up the stairs and jumping into the empty bed in a tangle of arms and legs, and playful, drunken kisses. Slowly, carefully, she tucks Noah into herself and gets off the sofa. She climbs the stairs and goes to the door of Tallulah's room. It's wide open, just as she left it at 11 o'clock the night before when she came to collect Noah. She lowers him gently into his cot, and, miraculously, he does not stir. Then she sits on the side of Tallulah's bed and calls her phone again. Once more, it goes straight to voicemail. She calls Zach. It goes to voicemail. She continues this ping-pong game for another hour. The sun is fully risen now. It is morning, but too early to call anyone else. So, Kim makes herself a coffee and cuts herself a slice of bread off the farmhouse loaf she always buys Tallulah for the weekend and eats it with butter and honey bought from the beekeeper down the road who sells it from his front door. And she waits and waits for the day to begin. Chapter 2, August 2018.
Mr. Gray, welcome.
Sophie sees a silver-haired man striding towards them down the wood-panelled corridor. His hand is already extended towards them, although he has another 10 feet to cover. He gets to Sean and grasps his hand warmly, wrapping it inside both of his as if Sean is a small child with cold hands that need warming up. Then he turns to Sophie and says,
Mrs. Gray, so lovely to meet you at last.
Miss Beck, actually. Sorry, says Sophie.
Ah, yes, of course, stupid of me. I did know that. Miss Beck, Peter Doody, executive head.
Peter Doody beams at her. His teeth are unnaturally white for a man in his early 60s.
And I hear you are a novelist.
Sophie nods.
What sort of books do you write?
Detective novels, she replies.
Detective novels? Well, well, well. I'm sure you'll find lots to inspire you here at Maypole House. There's never a dull day. Just make sure you change the names.
He laughs loudly at his own joke.
Where have you parked?
He asks Sean, indicating the driveway beyond the huge doorway.
Oh, says Sean.
Just there, next to you. I hope that's okay.
Perfect, just perfect.
He peers over Sean's shoulder.
And the little ones?
With their mother in London.
Ah, yes, of course.
Sophie and Sean follow Peter Doody, wheeling their suitcases down one of the three long corridors that branch off the main hallway. They push through double doors and into a glass tunnel that connects the old house to the modern block, and continue wheeling the cases out of a door at the back of the modern block and down a curved path towards a small Victorian cottage. It backs directly onto woodland and is surrounded by a ring of rose bushes just coming into late summer bloom. Peter takes a bunch of keys from his pocket and removes a pair on a brass ring. Sophie has seen the cottage once before, but only as the home of the previous head teacher, filled with their furnishings and ephemera, their dogs, their photographs. Peter unlocks the door, and they follow him into the flagstoned back hallway. The Wellington boots have gone, the waxed jackets and dog leads hanging from the hooks. There is a petrolic smoky smell in here, and a cold draft coming up from between the floorboards, which makes the cottage feel strangely wintry on this dog day of a long hot summer. Maypole House is in the picturesque village of Upfield Common in the Surrey Hills. It was once the manor house of the village until 20 years ago, when it was bought up by a company called Magenta that owns schools and colleges all over the world and turned into a private boarding school for 16 to 19-year-olds who flunked their GCSEs and A-levels first time round. So yes, a school for failures, in essence. And Sophie's boyfriend, Sean, is now the new head teacher.
Here.
Peter tips the keys into Sean's hand.
All yours. When is the rest of your stuff arriving?
3 o'clock, replies Sean.
Peter checks the time on his Apple Watch and says,
Well then, looks like you've got plenty of time for a pub lunch. My treat.
Oh, Sean looks at Sophie. We brought lunch with us, actually.
He indicates a canvas bag on the floor by his feet.
But thank you anyway.
Peter seems unperturbed.
Well, just for future reference, the local pub is superb. The Swan and Ducks, other side of the common, does a kind of Mediterranean mezze tapas type of menu. The calamari stew is incredible and an excellent wine cellar. Manager there will give you a discount when you tell him who you are.
He looks at his watch again and says,
Well, anyway, I'll let you both settle in. All the codes are here. You'll need this one to let the van in when it arrives, and this one is for the front door. Your card will operate all the interior doors.
He hands them a lanyard each.
And I will be back tomorrow morning for our first day's work. FYI, you may see some strangely dressed folk around. There's been an external residential course running here all week, some kind of glee type thing. It's the last day today. They'll be leaving tomorrow. And Carrie Ann Mulligan, the matron. You met her last week, I believe?
Sean nods.
She's looking after the group, so you don't need to worry yourself about them. And that, I think, is that. Except, oh.
He strides towards the fridge and opens the door.
A little something from Magenta to you.
A single bottle of cheap champagne sits in the empty fridge. He closes the door, puts his hands into the pockets of his blue chinos, and then takes them out again to shake both their hands. And then he is gone, and Sean and Sophie are alone in their new home for the very first time. They look at each other, and then around, and then at each other again. Sophie bends down to the canvas bag and pulls out the two wine glasses she'd packed this morning as they prepared to leave Sean's house in Lewisham. She unwraps them from tissue paper, rests them on the counter, pulls open the fridge and grabs the champagne. Then she takes Sean's outstretched hand and follows him to the garden. It's west-facing and cast in shade at this time of the day, but it's still just warm enough to sit with bare arms. While Sean uncorks the champagne and pours them each a glass, Sophie lets her gaze roam across the view. A wooden gate between the rose bushes that form the boundary of the back garden leads to a velvety green woodland, interspersed with patches of lawn onto which the midday sun falls through the treetops into pools of gold. She can hear the sound of birds chittering in the branches. She can hear the champagne bubbles fizzing in the wine glasses. She can hear her own breath in her lungs, the blood passing through the veins on her temples. She notices Sean looking at her.
"Thank you," he says. "Thank you so much."
"What for?"
"You know what for."
He takes her hands in his.
"How much you're sacrificing to be here with me. I don't deserve you. I really don't."
"You do deserve me. I'm sloppy seconds, remember?" They smile wryly at each other. This is one of the many unpleasant things that Sean's ex-wife Pippa had found to say about Sophie when she'd first found out about her. Also, she looks so much older than 34. And she has a strangely flat backside.
"Well, whatever you are, you're the best. And I love you."
He kisses her knuckles hard and then lets her hands go so that she can pick up her glass. "Pretty, isn't it?" Sophie says dreamily, staring through the back gate and into the woods. "Where do they go?"
"I have no idea," he replies. "Maybe you should go for a wander after lunch."
"Yes," says Sophie. "Maybe I will." Sean and Sophie have only been together for 6 months. They met when Sophie came to Sean's school to give a talk about publishing and writing to a group of his A-level English students. He took her for lunch as a thank you, and at first she felt nervous, as if she'd done something wrong. The association between being alone with an older male teacher and having done something wrong was buried so deep into her psyche she couldn't override it. But then she'd noticed that he had very, very dark brown eyes, almost black, and that his shoulders were broad, and that he had a wonderful, warm, hearty laugh, and a soft mouth, and no wedding band. And then she realised that he was flirting with her. And then there was an email from him in her inbox a day later, sent from his private email address, thanking her for coming in and wondering if she might like to try the new Korean place they chatted about at lunch the previous day. Maybe on Friday night. And she'd thought, "I have never been on a date with a man in his 40s. I have never been on a date with a man who wears a tie to work, and I have not, in fact, been on a date for 5 full years, and I really would like to try the new Korean place, so why not?" It was during their first date that Sean told her he was leaving the big secondary school in Lewisham, where he was head of sixth form, at the end of the term to be a head teacher at a private boarding sixth form college in the Surrey Hills. Not because he wanted to be in the private sector, working in a mahogany-lined office, but because his ex-wife Pippa was moving their twins from the perfectly nice state primary they'd both been at for 3 years to an expensive private school and expected him to contribute half of their school fees. At first, the implications of this development hadn't really hit Sophie. March tumbled into April, tumbled into May, tumbled into June, and she and Sean became closer and closer, and their lives became more and more entwined. And then Sophie met Sean's twins, who let her put them to bed and read them stories and comb their hair. And then it was the summer holidays, and she and Sean started to spend even more time together. And then one night, drinking cocktails on a roof terrace overlooking the Thames, Sean said,
"Come with me. Come with me to Maypole House."
Sophie's gut reaction had been, "No. No, 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 no." She was a Londoner. She was independent. She had a career of her own, a social life. Her family lived in London. But as July turned to August, and Sean's departure drew ever closer, and the fabric of her life started to feel as though it was stretching out of shape, she turned her thinking around. Maybe, she thought, it would be nice to live in the countryside. Maybe she could focus more on work, without all the distractions of city living. Maybe she'd enjoy the status of being the head teacher's partner, the cachet of being the first lady of such an exclusive place. She went with Sean to visit the school, and she walked around the cottage and felt the warm solidity of the terracotta tiles beneath her feet, smelled the sensuous fragrances of wild roses, of freshly mowed grass, of sun-warmed jasmine through the back door. She saw a space below a window in the hallway that was just the right size for her writing desk, with a view across the school grounds. She thought, I am 34. Soon, I will be 35. I have been alone for a long, long time. Maybe I should do this ridiculous thing. And so she said yes. She and Sean made the most of every minute of their last few weeks in London. They sat on every pavement terrace in South London, ate every kind of obscure ethnic cuisine, watched films in multi-story car parks, wandered around pop-up food fairs, picnicked in the park to the background sounds of grime music and sirens and diesel engines. They spent 10 days in Mallorca in a cool Airbnb in downtown Palma with a balcony overlooking the marina. They'd spent weekends with Sean's children and took them to the South Bank to run through the fountains, for al fresco lunches at Giraffe and Oaxaca, to the Tate Modern, to the playgrounds in Kensington Gardens. And then she'd let her one-bedroom flat in New Cross to a friend, cancelled her gym membership, signed out of her Tuesday night writers group, packed some boxes, and joined Sean here, in the middle of nowhere. And now, as the sun shines down through the tops of the towering trees, splashing dapples onto the dark fabric of her dress and the ground beneath her feet, Sophie starts to feel the beginning of happiness, a sense that this decision born of pragmatism might in fact have been some kind of magical act of destiny unfurling, that they were meant to be here, that this will be good for her, good for both of them. Sean takes their lunch things through to the kitchen. She hears the tap go on and the clatter of dishes being laid down in the butler's sink. I'm going for a wander, she calls to Sean through the open window. She turns to put the latch on the gate as she leaves the back garden, and as she does so, her eye is caught by something nailed to the wooden fence. A piece of cardboard, a flap torn from a box by the look of it. Scrawled on it in marker and with an arrow pointing down to the earth are the words, Dig here. She stares at it curiously for a moment. Maybe, she thinks, it's left over from a treasure trail, a party game, or a team-building exercise from the glee course that he's finishing today. Maybe, she thinks, it's a time capsule. But then something else flashes through her mind, a jolting déjà vu, a certainty that she has seen this exact thing before. A cardboard sign nailed to a fence. The words, Dig here, in black marker pen. A downward pointing arrow. She has seen this before. But she cannot for the life of her remember where. Chapter 3, June 2017. Zach's mum is older than Kim. Zach is her youngest child. She has another four, all girls, all much older than him. Her name is Megs. She answers the door to Kim in combat shorts and a voluminous green linen top, sunglasses on her head, a patch of sunburn on the bridge of her nose. Kim, she says. Then she turns immediately to Noah and beams at him. Hello, my beautiful bubba, she says. She chucks him under the chin and then glances back at Kim. Everything okay? Have you seen the kids? Kim says, hitching Noah onto her other hip. She walked here without the pram. It's hot, and Noah is heavy. Tallulah, you mean, and Zach? Yeah. She shifts Noah again. No, I mean, they're at yours, aren't they? No. They went to the pub last night. No sign of them now, and they're not answering their phones. I thought maybe they might have come back to yours to crash. No, love, no. Just me and Simon here. Do you want to come in? We're just out in the garden. We can try calling them again. In Meg's back garden, Kim lowers Noah down onto the grass next to a push-along plastic toy that he attempts to pull himself up onto. Megs takes out her phone and presses in her son's number. Megs's husband Simon nods at Kim curtly and then turns back to his newspaper. Kim's always had a horrible feeling that Simon finds her attractive and that his offhand manner is his way of dealing with how uncomfortable this makes him feel. Meg scowls and ends the call.
Straight through to voicemail, she says. Let me call Nick.
Kim throws her a questioning look.
You know, the barman from the Ducks. Hold on.
She prods the screen of her phone with blue acrylic nails.
Nick, love, it's Megs. How are you? How's your mum?
Good, good.
Listen, were you working last night? You didn't happen to see Zach in there, did you?
Kim watches Megs nod a lot, listens to her making receptive noises. She pulls a lump of earth from Noah's hand just as he's about to press it into his mouth and waits patiently. Finally, Megs ends the call.
Apparently, she says, Zach and Tallulah went off after the pub to someone's house. Someone Tallulah knows from college.
Yeah, I know that, but any idea who?
Scarlett someone, and a couple of others. Nick seemed to think they were heading out of the village. They went in a car.
Scarlett?
Yeah, Nick said she's one of the posh kids from the Maypole.
Kim nods. She's never heard of a Scarlett. But then Tallulah doesn't really talk much to her about college. Once she's home, Noah is pretty much the only topic of conversation in the house.
Anything else? She asks, pulling Noah onto her lap. That's all he had, I'm afraid.
Meg smiles at Noah and stretches her arms out towards him. But he curls himself closer to Kim and she sees Meg's smile falter.
Should we be worried, do you think?
Kim shrugs.
I honestly don't know.
Have you tried calling Tallulah's friends?
I don't have any numbers for them. They're all on her phone.
Meg sighs and leans back into her chair.
It's strange, she says.
If it wasn't for the baby, I'd just assume they were sleeping something off somewhere. You know, they're so young and God knows the things I got up to at their age. But they're both so devoted, aren't they, to Noah? Just seems a bit...
I know, Kim nods. It does.
Kim wishes that she and Megs were closer, but Megs never seemed to believe in Zach and Tallulah as a couple, and then after Noah was born, she backed off completely for a while, barely visiting Noah and acting like a distracted aunt when she did. And now she's missed her moment with Noah. He recognises her, but doesn't know that she's important.
Anyway, Kim says, I'll go and do some research into the Scarlet thing. See what I can dig up. But hopefully I won't need to. Hopefully they'll be home by the time I get back, looking sheepish.
Megs smiles.
You know what?
She says brightly in a tone of voice that suggests that she really just wants to get back to relaxing in the garden, in the sun. That she really isn't in the mood for worry.
I bet you anything they are.
In Tallulah's room, Kim rifles through the contents of her school bag. Tallulah is studying social care. She wants to be a social worker. Most of her coursework is done at home, and she only has to go into college 3 times a week. Kim watches her at the bus stop from the front window sometimes, her fresh-faced baby in her casual college gear, her hair tied back, clutching a folder to her chest. Nobody would ever guess that she has a child of her own at home. She looks so young. Kim finds a planner in the bag and flicks through it. It's full of Tallulah's dense, somewhat inelegant handwriting. She'd started off left-handed and forced herself to learn to write with her right hand to fit in when she was at primary school. There's no point looking for phone numbers. No one writes down phone numbers anymore. But maybe Scarlett's name will appear on a class list or some such. And there it is, glued down and folded up on the back inside cover of the planner. Student contacts. Kim scans it quickly. Her finger coming to rest on the name, Scarlett Jacques, Student Event Planning Committee. And there's her email address. Kim immediately starts to type a message. Scarlett, this is Tallulah Murray's mum, Kim. Tallulah hasn't come home since going out last night and isn't answering her phone, and I wondered if you had any idea where she might be.
A friend said she was with someone called Scarlett. Please call me on this number as soon as possible. Many thanks. She presses send and then exhales and rests the phone on her lap. Downstairs, the front door clicks shut. It's 2 p.m. and it'll be her son Ryan home from work. He works in the grocers in the village every Saturday, saving up for his big summer holiday to Rhodes in August, his first without his mum, just with friends.
Are they back?
He calls up the stairs to her.
Nope,
she calls back down. She hears him dropping his keys on a surface, throwing his trainers into the pile of shoes by the front door, then bounding up the stairs.
Seriously, he says. Have they called?
No, not a word. She tells him about Meg's calling Nick at the pub and the girl called Scarlett, and as she talks, her phone rings with an unknown number. Hello?
Oh, hi, is this Lula's mum?
Yes, hi, this is Kim.
Hi, it's Scarlett here, I just got your email.
Kim's heart begins to race painfully, then skitter.
Oh,
she says. Scarlett, thank you, I just wondered... Scarlett cuts in.
They were at my house,
she says.
They left at about 3 a.m, that's all I can tell you.
Kim blinks, her head rocks back slightly.
And were they... did they say where they were going? They said they were going to get a cab home.
Kim doesn't like the tone of Scarlett's voice. She has one of those clipped chilly voices that tells of four-poster beds and bohemian private schools and gravel on the driveway. But she also sounds disinterested, as though talking to Kim is beneath her somehow.
And did they seem okay? I mean, had they had a lot to drink?
I guess, yeah. Lulu was sick. That's why they left.
She threw up.
Yeah.
Kim pictures her slight, kind girl bent double over a flower bed, and her heart lurches.
And did you see them get into a taxi?
No, they just left, and that was that.
And, sorry, but where do you live, Scarlett? Just so that I can ask around the local cab companies.
Dark Place, she replies. Near Upley Fold?
Street number?
No street number, just that.
Dark Place, near Upley Fold.
Oh, says Kim, drawing two rings around the words on the paper where she's written them down.
Okay, thank you, and please, if you hear anything from either of them, will you give me a ring? I mean, I don't know how well you know Tallulah.
Not that well, Scarlett interjects.
Yes, well, she's not the type just to disappear, not to come home. And she has a baby, you know?
There's a brief pause at the other end of the line, then...
No, I didn't know that.
Kim gives her head a small shake, tries to imagine how Zack and Tallulah could have spent a whole night with this girl without once mentioning Noah.
Well, yes, she and Zack are parents. They have a son. He's 12 months old, so not coming home is kind of a big deal.
There's another silence at the end of the line, and then Scarlett says,
Right, well, yeah.
Kim says, Call me, please, if you hear anything.
Yeah,
says Scarlett.
Sure, bye.
And then she ends the call. Kim stares at her phone for a moment. Then she looks up at Ryan, who has been watching the phone call curiously. Weird, says Kim. She relays the detail of the call to her son.
Shall we drive over there? He suggests.
To her house?
Scarlett's?
Yeah,
says Ryan.
Let's go to Dark Place.
Chapter 4, August 2018. Sean heads into work early the following morning. Sophie stands at the door of the cottage and watches as he disappears up the glass passageway towards the main school building. He turns at the double doors and waves at her, and then he is gone. The grounds of the school are full of people wheeling small cases behind them, heading towards the car park at the front of the school. The residential glee course is over. Summer is coming to an end. From tomorrow, the boarding school students will start returning. Cleaners wait in the shadows to enter their vacated rooms and prepare them for the new term. She heads back into the cottage now. It's a pleasant house. Functional.
The air inside is clammy and cool, with small windows grown over with ivy and wisteria branches that don't let in much light. It still smells of other people, and there's that odd damp bonfire smell in the hallway, which seems to emanate from between the floorboards. She's covered the floorboards over with a runner and placed a reed diffuser on the sideboard, but it still lingers. It's going to take a while to make the cottage feel like home, but it will. She knows it will. Sean's children are coming the weekend after next. That will bring it to life. Sophie turns to a box that she is halfway through unpacking when there is a knock at the door. Hello?
Oh, hi, it's Carrie Anne, the matron.
Sophie opens the door and sees a woman with thick golden hair held back with sunglasses, bright blue eyes and a sunburnished cleavage. She's wearing a maxi dress and bejeweled flip-flops. She does not look like a matron. Hi, says Sophie, reaching out to take her hand. Lovely to meet you.
You too. You must be Sophie.
Correct. Carrie Anne has a huge set of keys hanging from her hand.
How are you settling in?
She says, passing the keys from one hand to the other.
Got everything you need?
Yes, says Sophie. Yes, everything's just fine. Sean's first day, he headed into work about 10 minutes ago.
Yes, I just saw him. We exchanged pleasantries. Anyway, I wanted you to take my number, in case you need anything. Obviously, my primary function is student welfare, but I'll be keeping an eye out for you as well. I know how weird and new everything must be feeling, so please consider me to be your matron too. And if you're missing home and need a shoulder to cry on...
Sophie blinks, not sure if she's being serious or not, but Carrie Anne beams at her and says,
Just joking, but honestly, anything you need... Advice about the village, about the staff, the kids, whatever. Please, just text me. And I'm on the second floor of Alpha Block, just...
She crouches slightly to peer beneath an overhanging tree on the periphery of Sean and Sophie's garden.
That window there, with the balcony. Room number 205.
She passes Sophie a piece of paper with her details written on it in neat schoolteachery script. Is it just you?
Most of the time, yeah. My daughter comes to stay sometimes, Lexi. She's a travel blogger, so she comes and goes. But mostly it's just me. And I hear there'll be some little ones here from time to time.
Yes, Jack and Lily, twins. They're 7.
Oh, nice age. Right. Well, any questions, anything at all, just ask. I've worked here for 20 years. I've lived in the village for nearly 60. There's nothing I don't know about Upfield Common. In fact, you and Sean should come over for a drink tonight. I can chew your ears off over a glass of wine.
Oh, says Sophie. That would be lovely. Thank you. She is about to thank her again and head back indoors when her eye is caught by a pair of magpies taking flight from the treetops in the woodland beyond her garden. Those woods... She gestures at them. Where do they lead?
Oh, you don't want to go too far into those woods.
Sophie throws Carrie Anne a questioning look.
They go on for miles. You'll get lost.
Yes, but where do they come out?
Depends which direction you go in. There's a hamlet about 1.5 miles that way.
She points to the left.
Upley Fold Church, Village Hall, a few houses. It's quite pretty. And if you head straight for 1 mile or so...
She points ahead.
There's the back end of a big house. Dark Place, it's called. Empty now. It belongs to a hedge fund manager from the Channel Islands and his very glamorous wife.
She rolls her eyes slightly.
Their daughter was a student here for a while, actually. Scarlett, amazingly talented girl... But I really wouldn't recommend trying to get there. Students head over there sometimes because there's an old swimming pool and a tennis court, but then they can't find their way back and there's no signal in the woods. We even had to get the bloody police involved once.
She rolls her eyes again. Sophie nods. She's feeling a bristle of excitement. In London, when she needs writing inspiration, she'll walk up to Dulwich or Blackheath and look at the grand old houses there and imagine the stories that lie within. Now she thinks of her walking stick and her compass and her water bottle and the opportunity to get some proper steps on her fitness app. The sun is hazy. It's about 22 degrees. Perfect walking weather. The words old pool and tennis court swim through her imagination. She thinks of the dryness of the air of a house abandoned throughout a long hot summer, the bleached lawns, the dusty cracked flagstones, the birds nesting in grimy window casements. She smiles at Carrie-Anne. "I'll try to resist the urge," she says. Chapter 5. September 2016. Scarlett Jax is standing next to Tallulah in the queue at the canteen. She is 5'10", thin as a stick. Her bleached hair is dyed pale blue and gathered on top of her head in a bundle, and someone has drawn a tiny rainbow on her cheekbone. She's wearing a man's hoodie, with sleeves that come to her knuckles, and a pair of oversized jersey shorts with high-top trainers. Her fingers are covered with heavyweight rings, and her fingernails are painted green. She hovers over the miniature cereal boxes, her fingers dancing across their spines until they land decisively on Rice Krispies. She grabs it and adds it to her tray, next to a carton of chocolate soya milk and an apple. Tallulah watches her head to the till. Her people are already gravitating towards her, following in her wake, ensuring that they will find space next to her once she has decided where she will sit. Tallulah picks up a ham sandwich and an orange juice, and pays for them. She sits at a table close to Scarlett's. Scarlett sits with her long legs stretched out, her huge high-top trainers resting on the chair opposite her, her shins still boasting a silky summer tan. She opens the chocolate soya milk and pours it onto her Rice Krispies, then lowers her face to the bowl and shovels them into her mouth with a spoon. At one point, she spills chocolate milk down her chin and wipes it away with a cuff of her hoodie. She's with the kids she always hangs around with. Tallulah doesn't know their names. Scarlett and her clique all used to go to the posh school in Tallulah's village, Maypole House, which has a reputation for being for thick rich kids, or rich kids with behavioural issues, or rich kids with ADHD, or rich kids with drug abuse problems. They screech around the village in their convertible mini clubmans, stalk into the local pubs with their fake IDs and their loud voices and their rich kid hair. In the co-op, you could hear them before you saw them, calling to each other across the aisles about how there was no fresh mozzarella, then talking across the heads of the village teenagers manning the tills as if they didn't exist. Now, a small group of them has, for some unknown reason, ended up at the local FE college in Manton, the nearest town. Most of them are in their first year of a fine art diploma. A couple of them are studying fashion. They clearly all come from families that had expected them to end up in good universities, and instead had ended up at Manton College of Further Education. And consequently, there is a defensiveness about them. Tallulah puts a hand to her belly. The flesh there is still so loose and blubbery. It's been nearly 3 months since she gave birth, but it feels like half her insides are still made of baby. She just stopped breastfeeding a week ago, and her breasts still leak sometimes, and she keeps pads inside her bra. She switches on her phone and looks at the photo of Noah on her home screen. Her stomach flips, a mixture of unbearable love and fear. For 3 months, she and Noah have been inseparable. Her first day at college last week was the first time she'd left him for longer than a few minutes. Now, he is half an hour away from her, a bus ride, 6.5 miles away, and her arms feel weightless, her breasts feel heavy. She texts her mum, "All okay?" Her mum replies immediately, "Just got back from looking at the ducks, all good." At the next table, Scarlett has zoned out from talking to her clique and is staring at her phone in a way that suggests she's not really looking at anything. She rolls the apple on the tray round and round with the fingers of her spare hand. Her face in profile is interesting. There is a bump in her nose, a slight curve to her chin. Her mouth is a thin line. But still, she is somehow pretty. Prettier than any other girl at the college. even the ones with perfect noses and pillow lips. She turns and catches Tallulah staring at her. She narrows her eyes, then turns away from her, drops her feet back to the floor, picks up the apple, tucks it in the pocket of her hoodie, and leaves her group of friends without saying goodbye to any of them. As she passes Tallulah, she narrows her eyes again, and Tallulah imagines for a split second that she sees a smile pass across her face. Chapter 6, June 2017. Kim buckles Noah into his car seat and gives him one of his fabric books to flick through. Ryan sits in the back with him while Kim gets into the driver's seat and switches on her phone to put the address into Google. Dark place, she says as she types. It's only a mile away. I wonder why I've never heard of it before. She slots her phone into its holder, presses start, and pulls out of the quiet cul-de-sac where she has lived since she was 21 years old. She hums distractedly under her breath. She doesn't want Noah to pick up on her anxiety, doesn't want Ryan to have to deal with her mounting feelings of dread and fear. They drive through the sun-dappled lanes that connect Upfield Common with Manton, the nearest big town. Just before the large roundabout that marks the end of the village, Google tells them to turn right, up a tight dogleg. The signpost is overgrown with buddleia, but Kim can just make out the words, Upley Fold, half a mile. It's a single-lane road, and she drives cautiously in case she meets a vehicle coming the other way. It's nearly 4 p.m, and the sun is still high in the sky. She peers into the rear-view mirror and says to Ryan, Can you put the screen down on Noah's side? He's in full sun. Ryan leans across and pulls it down. Noah points at something in his fabric book and attempts to tell Ryan what it is, but he hasn't learned how to talk yet. So Ryan just looks at the page and says, Yes, Piggy. That's right, Piggy. Google tells her to take the next turning on the right. She cannot believe that there is actually a turning on the right, but there it is. A track with a line of meadow grass running down its centre. The hedgerows lower here so Kim can see blinding fields of rape, some cows silhouetted in the distance, a cluster of cottages. And then, after another few minutes, a pair of metal gates, a gravel driveway pointing due south, the name Dark Place, fashioned out of wrought iron, the suggestion of a turreted house in the distance. Kim turns off the engine and puts her phone into her handbag. What are you going to do? Asks Ryan. Her eyes scan the gate for a doorbell or entry system, but there's nothing. A footpath runs alongside the gravel drive. She gets Noah's pushchair out of the boot and assembles it, batting midges out of her face. Come on, she says to Ryan, unclipping the fastenings on Noah's seat. We're going to walk. Ryan uses his phone to Google Dark Place, and he gives her a running commentary from its wiki page as they walk. Kim enjoys the distraction from her thoughts. It was built in 1643, he says. Wow, 1643, he repeats. But most of it got burned down a few years after it was built. It lay empty for 70 years, and that's how it got the name Dark Place, because of the charred wood that surrounded it. The Georgian wing was added in 1721, and the Victorian wing in the late 1800s by a coffee plantation owner called Frederick de Thames. Who? God. He pauses and scrolls back. Who fathered at least 38 children in Colombia, 7 in the UK, and died of the Spanish flu when he was only 41. The house was left to his last wife, Carolina de Thames, who was only 20 when he died, and who passed it on in turn to her son, Lawrence. In 1931, three of Frederick's older children plotted to have Lawrence assassinated, but the man they hired to kill him got caught in a fox trap in the grounds of Dark Place and wasn't found until 6 days later, when he'd been partially eaten by foxes and had his eyes pecked out by crows. He had the assassination orders on a signed form in the pocket of his coat. The three brothers who'd plotted Lawrence's death were sent to prison, and Lawrence lived in the house until he died in 1998. Whereupon, with no living heirs, the house went back on the market and was purchased by an unknown buyer for nearly £2 million in 2002. As they walk, Kim casts her eyes across the ground, across the horizon, all around her looking for signs of her daughter. She'd called all three local taxi companies before leaving the house, and none of them had collected anyone from Dark Place last night. They walk for nearly 10 minutes, until finally she sees the house. It looks just as Kim had expected it to look, from Ryan's description. A hodgepodge of disparate architectural styles, blended almost seamlessly together across three wings, set around a central courtyard. The sun sparkles off the diamonds of leaded windows on the left wing and the larger Victorian casement and sash windows on the right. It should be a mess, but it is not. It is exquisitely beautiful. In the driveway are four cars and a golf buggy. Even from here, Kim can hear the sound of people splashing in a swimming pool. Ryan helps her pull Noah's buggy up the steps to the front door, and she rings the bell. A young man answers. A huge St. Bernard dog follows behind and collapses, panting at his feet. The man is bare-chested and holding a six-pack of beers in one hand and a tea towel in the other. He looks from Kim to Noah to Ryan and back to Kim.
Hi.
Oh, hi, my name is Kim. I wondered if Scarlett was around, or her parents.
Yeah, sure. Hold on a sec.
He turns and yells out,
Mom, someone for you at the door.
Behind him, Kim sees a pale stone staircase with a striped runner up the middle. She sees modern art and designer light fittings, and then a woman in a loose white sundress and white flip-flops appears. The dog stands heavily to greet the woman, who peers at Kim curiously through the door. The boy smiles at Kim and then disappears.
Yes?
Says the woman. Sorry to disturb you like this on a Saturday. The woman looks across her shoulder at the gravel sweep and says,
How did you get here?
Oh, says Kim. We parked at the gate and walked.
But that's half a mile. You should have rung the bell.
Well, we looked, but we couldn't see one.
Oh, yes, sorry, it's a movement sensor. You need to stand over it. Lots of people miss it. You should have called.
Well, I didn't have a number, or at least I had a number, but I didn't realise how far the house was going to be from the gate. But anyway, it's fine. I'm looking for my daughter.
Oh,
she says.
Are you Mimi's mum? I think she left this morning.
No, says Kim. No, sorry, I'm not Mimi's mum. I'm Tallulah's mum. She was here last night.
Tallulah?
The woman scruffs the dog's head absent-mindedly, with a hand bearing just one wide band on her wedding finger.
Gosh, no, I don't think I know a Tallulah.
Lula, she suggests. She hates the name Lula, but her daughter's friends have always tended to shorten her full name. It's something she's learned to accept.
No.
The woman shakes her head.
No, I've never heard of Lula either. Are you sure she was here?
Kim is hot and anxious. There's no shade where she's standing, and the sun is beating down on the back of her neck. She can feel a hot dampness breaking out all over her body and feels a flash of anger at this woman in her crisp white sundress and freshly brushed hair, her cool, dry complexion, and the suggestion in her clipped English accent that Kim is somehow mistaken and in the wrong place. She nods and tries to keep her voice pleasant. Yes, I spoke to your daughter a couple of hours ago. She said Tallulah was here last night with her boyfriend, Zach, and they left in a minicab at 3 a.m. But I've called all the minicab numbers and none of them has a record of a pickup from this address or anywhere in the vicinity of this address. And it's nearly 4 p.m. and my daughter is still not home and this... She points behind her at Noah in his buggy. Is Tallulah's son and she would never deliberately leave him, just never. Her voice begins to crack dangerously, and she breathes in hard to stop herself from crying. The woman looks unperturbed by this display of emotion.
Sorry,
she says after a pause.
What was your name again?
Kim, and this is Ryan, my son, and Noah, my grandson.
Gosh, says the woman. A grandmother? You look far too young to be a grandmother. Anyway, I'm Joss.
She puts out a hand for Kim to shake and then says, "Come on, let's go and see what Scarlett has to say about all of this. Follow me." She leads them across the courtyard and through a tall wrought iron gate set in an ancient brick wall grown over with ivy. The huge dog pads heavily behind them. The courtyard is smattered with tiny white stone figures set on perspex plinths. They follow her down a flagstoned path lined with sculptural plants in cobalt-glazed pots and then turn a corner. In front of them is the pool. It's set in a cream marble terrace with a curtained pagoda at one end housing a huge cream-cushioned daybed. At angles along its length are wooden steamers with matching cream cushions. Floating at the pool's centre inside a bright pink inflatable flamingo is a tall, thin girl with lime green hair and a black bandeau bikini top. She peers at Kim and her entourage curiously. Then she says, "Oh," as the penny drops. "Tallulah," says Joss, shielding her eyes from the sun shining off the pool's surface with her hand. "Apparently she was here last night. Any idea where she got to?" Scarlett pushes herself to the pool's edge by paddling her hands through the water. Then she dismounts the flamingo and ascends the stone steps. She pulls a black towel around herself and sits down at a teak circular table covered with white candles in glass jars. Kim sits opposite her. "I know," she begins. "You said that you don't know where they went. I know you said that Tallulah was sick and they got in a minicab, but the cab firms are all saying that they didn't pick anyone up from here. I just wondered if there was anything else that happened last night that might explain where they are." Scarlett picks at the wax on the top of one of the candles and makes no eye contact with Kim. "Genuinely," she says, "honestly, that's all I know." "And did you see them getting into a car?" "No, I was out here with Mimi, and Zach came and said Lula had been sick and he was going to take her home, that there was a taxi coming." "He said that, that the taxi was coming, or did he say he was going to call one?" Scarlett shrugs. Kim watches crystal beads of pool water coalesce and collapse on her angular shoulders and run down her arms in rivulets. "I'm pretty sure he said one was coming." Kim can see Ryan hovering in her peripheral view. She pulls out a chair for him, and he sits down, bringing Noah's pushchair close to him. "So, is there a chance, do you think, that Zach tried to call a taxi and no one could send one, so they ended up walking?"
"Yeah," says Scarlett. "I guess."
Kim turns to Scarlett's brother, who is perched on the end of a steamer across the pool, with a bottle of beer hanging between his knees.
"Were you here last night at the party?"
She calls over to him. He puts out a hand defensively and says,
"No, no, not me. I just got home this morning."
Kim sighs. "And if they had walked, where might they have ended up?" Scarlett shrugs again.
"It depends, I suppose, on which way they went. If they went up the driveway, they could have ended up on the main road or Upley Fold. If they turned the wrong way, if they went the back path, they would have ended up back in Upfield Common."
"The back path?"
"Yeah,"
she replies, waving her hand in a vague arc behind her.
"There."
Kim gazes over her shoulder. All she can see are lawns and flower beds and hedges and gravel pathways and pockmarked stone steps and sundials and arbours.
"Where?"
"Beyond,"
says Scarlett.
"Behind. There's a path there that goes through the woods and into the back end of Upfield Common, near the maple. I used to walk that way to school sometimes when I was there."
"How far?" Joss interjects.
"A mile, just over, but I wouldn't recommend it, especially not with a baby. You really need to know where you're going, otherwise you'll get lost."
"Did Tallulah know about the back path?"
Scarlett shrugs.
"I don't think so," she said. "She'd never been here before, so there's no reason she should have known about it."
"And who else?" Kim continues. "Who else was here last night?"
"Just us three," says Scarlett.
"And Mimi. Lexi Mulligan was here before they left. She lives at Maypole House. Her mum's the matron there. You know Kerri-Ann Mulligan?"
Kim nods. She knows Kerri-Ann well. Everyone in Upfield Common knows Kerri-Ann. She's larger than life.
Yeah, her daughter, she's like in her 20s, but she left early. She was driving, and she took my friend Liam with her.
So after that, it was just you, Tallulah, Zach, and Mimi.
Yep.
And your mum and dad?
Mum was here. She was asleep. Dad's away on business?
Kim turns to Joss, who is sitting on the steps behind her, listening into the conversation. You don't happen to have security cameras, do you? Anywhere in the grounds? Joss nods and says,
Yes, tons of them. But I'm afraid I haven't got the vaguest idea how to use them.
She glances across at her son.
Rex? Any idea how to look at the camera footage?
Rex grimaces.
Not really. I know there's like some kind of centralized panel in Dad's study, but I've never actually used it.
Kim says, Do you think we might try? And as she says it, she feels the mood change immediately. Until now, she's been a minor distraction, entertained on their own terms. Now she's asking people to go indoors, to open doors, work out how to use equipment. She sees the three of them exchange looks. Then Joss gets to her feet and approaches Kim and says,
Tell you what, save us all traipsing about in Martin's office. Why don't I just get Rex to have a look in a bit? I'll get him to give Martin a ring to talk him through it. Scarlett's got your number. We'll call you if we find anything.
Kim still has so many things she wants to ask, so many questions she needs answers to. She's not ready to go. You said Tallulah hadn't been here before, she asks, a hint of desperation in her voice. And on the phone earlier, you said you didn't really know her. I mean, you didn't even know she had a child, so what, I mean, why was she even here?
Scarlett pulls the towel over her shoulders like a cloak and rubs at her ears with its corners.
We chat sometimes, she says. At college. Then I saw her in the pub last night, and we had a few drinks, and one thing led to another.
Kim's eyes take her in again, this lanky, angular girl with whom her daughter chatted sometimes. She takes in the detail of her, the piercings that catch the light, the tattoo on her shoulder blade, the perfectly painted toenails, and her gaze alights on a black mark on Scarlett's foot, a small tattoo, a pair of letters that she can't at first quite make out. Then she sees that it is the trademark symbol. Scarlett's hand reaches down and covers the tattoo, hard and fast, like swatting a fly. Their eyes meet briefly, and Kim sees something defensive and raw pass over Scarlett's face. She hitches her bag onto her shoulder. Would it be possible, she says, to speak to your friend Mimi, do you think? Do you have a number for her?
She won't know anything more than I do.
Please.
I'll get her to call you, says Scarlett.
Within a minute, they are pushing Noah's buggy back through the wrought iron gate and onto the front courtyard, and Joss is standing under a bower of passion flowers with her gigantic dog, waving them off. And as they walk towards the driveway, Kim hears the splash of bodies hitting the cool blue surface of the swimming pool, a small squeal of laughter. Chapter 7, August 2018. Sophie comes from an outdoorsy family. They go on walking holidays and sailing holidays and skiing holidays. Her father runs marathons, her mother plays golf and tennis. Both her brothers work in the sports industry. Sophie was once a swimmer. She has medals and cups and certificates in a big box in her parents' loft and still has a swimmer's physique, although she barely swims at all these days. When they were all small and getting on her mother's nerves, she would zip them into their coats and lock them in the back garden. They would moan for a while and then find something to do, usually involving climbing very tall trees and swinging off things that weren't designed to be swung off. So Sophie is very comfortable being outdoors and confident in her ability to find her way about and deal with obstacles alone without assistance. And so she sets off into the woods, sensibly dressed and equipped with water, energy bars, a mobile charger for her phone, her compass, some plasters, sun cream, a hat,
and a packet of bright red plastic space marker cones that she can drop on the forest floor at intervals if she needs to find her way back. Inside the woods, the tree cover is